Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with statistician Sir Richard Peto for another in a long line of interviews we've done since 1990, none of which, incidentally, in terms of disclosure, has he accepted an honorarium. And our discussion this time focused on a stunning data set just presented at the December San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, findings from the ATLAS trial conducted by his statistical group at Oxford over the last two decades, comparing 5 to 10 years of adjuvant tamoxifen. However, Dr. Peto began our conversation by reflecting back on the global impact of a number of seemingly modest steps forward in clinical research that have resulted in a surprisingly positive impact on breast cancer mortality.
Both in Britain and in America over the last 25 years, there's been quite a remarkable change in breast cancer mortality, and it's been due to earlier diagnosis and better treatment. Before the 1980s, breast cancer death rates were drifting slowly upwards in Britain and in America, and this was because we were better nourished in early childhood, and so the period started earlier, and that actually increases your risk of breast cancer later on. People were having fewer kids before they were 30, and so that increases risk of breast cancer. There was more obesity in postmenopausal women, well, more overweight anyway in postmenopausal women. That increases risk of breast cancer. And so for all these things, breast cancer death rates were drifting slowly upwards. And then we got changes in treatment. We got changes in how soon we were picking cancers up. We were getting them earlier. And we got improvements in treatment. And as a result of these changes, in total, breast cancer death rates are now half of what they would have been if the patterns of the 1980s had carried on, with things drifting slowly upwards. And in the United States, instead of 2.2% of women dying in middle age, which is what would have happened at current death rates, we'd see 1.1% of women dying in middle age. It's half what it would have been. But that halving of breast cancer mortality hasn't been produced by any big breakthrough. It's been produced by a lot of small gains. It's been produced by gains that are so small that if you just looked at them on your own, you'd say, well, that's not very interesting. Small gains from earlier diagnosis, small gains from screening, small gains from introducing hormonal therapy, small gains from getting it better, small gains from introducing chemotherapy, small gains from getting it better. But all these things together, all these small gains together, add up to a halving of the death rate. So the number of deaths from breast cancer still is much bigger than you'd want it to be, but it would be twice as many as it is now, the number of deaths from breast cancer in middle age, if we hadn't had these gains over the last 25 years. So what I'll describe later on in this interview is a lot of small gains, but remember that they do add up to a halving of death rates.
So let's talk about another one of these modest steps forward, the ATLAS data now supporting extended endocrine treatment for 10 years or maybe more. Can you talk a little bit about the background to this question and the meta-analysis that your group started in the 1980s that preceded it?
It was thought in the early 1980s that drugs like this might slow cancers down for a bit, but they wouldn't cure anybody, that nobody would be cured by this, and there wasn't any expectation that they would affect survival. So we asked everybody in the world who'd been doing a study of tamoxifen to share their data with us, put the studies all together and see what we got in total. And when you put all the studies together, which is what we did in 1985, then there was a small gain, 2 or 3% improvement in survival, absolute. So, you know, you might take, say, 32.5% dead down to about 30% dead. Well, in terms of five-year survival, it would be lower risks than that, but an absolute gain of 2.5%. Not very big, but still, at least it was real. And people were excited by that because it's just been so difficult to make any progress. This was sort of evidence that we got some progress. And then in the late 1980s, we kept on following up those trials and they all shared their data again in 1990. And actually, before they all shared their data in 1990, we sent a questionnaire around to everybody who'd actually done one of these trials and said, what do you think the 10-year results are going to look like? How do you think they're going to compare with the 5-year results? Will they be better? Will they be worse? Will they be the same? What will the gain be? Some people predicted that there'd be a slight extra gain. Some people predicted that you'd lose some of what you'd already gained. Some people predicted no further gain, no further loss. Some people predicted that you'd lose everything that you gained at 5 years, that at 10 years there'd be no further gain. And actually, the gain out at 10 years after your diagnosis, the survival gain turned out to be 5%. It was twice as big as the survival gain at 5 years. And not one of those experts who'd done the trials predicted that the gain would be as big as it actually was. They'd all underestimated the average of their predictions. The extra gain between year 5, year 10 was zero, because people had a sort of prejudice that you can't cure anybody. And they were sort of reluctant to abandon that prejudice. And so 1990, we got really good evidence of a nice effect on 10-year survival. And the only query was, well, OK, if it's so good, then why don't the national mortality trends reflect this? And, you know, we said, just wait and see. And we said, it's just too soon to see. And actually, within a few years, it was clear that the national mortality trends were reflecting this, that you were getting decreases in breast cancer mortality during the 1990s, a little bit bigger in Britain than in the United States, because we'd gone ahead with tamoxifen a bit earlier. But, you know, really, it's very nice in both countries. And so since then, we've got evidence that 2 years of tamoxifen isn't as good as 5 years of tamoxifen. If you give tamoxifen for 5 years, it's more effective than you give it for just 2 years. So there's another small gain. And then the next question in the 1990s was, well, would 10 years of tamoxifen be better than 5 years of tamoxifen? And although we started asking that question in the early 1990s, and we started the big trials that have now answered that question in the mid-1990s, it's only now that they've produced what I would call preliminary results. But the preliminary results show, yes, 10 years of tamoxifen is better than 5 years of tamoxifen. It's another small gain. So it's a long, long story, but it's quite a nice story.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's funny. I was just flashing back. I actually was in Oxford in that lecture hall in 1990. You were nice enough to invite me as an observer. And I remember just sitting in the back, and every piece of data that you were putting up there, you were showing what they predicted first and what they actually saw. It was really something I'll never forget. And the other thing I was flashing as you were talking, I think it was the 2000 NIH Consensus Conference. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the history, because at that point, I think there was like an NCI clinical alert telling people don't go beyond 5 years, because there had been a study out there from the NSABP that said maybe it could even be harmful. And I remember you standing up at that consensus conference saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and look at this and get the numbers you need. And it was kind of controversial for change.
Well, it was controversial. I think the problem is that if you want to work out how to treat millions of women, then you often need to randomize a few tens of thousands. You need to randomize perhaps 20,000 women, 10,000 get the new treatment, 10,000 don't. And then you say, well, does it really make any difference to long-term survival? If you do it with only 2,000 women, 1,000 versus 1,000, you can get the wrong answer. You can get a false negative. It can seem that it does nothing, or it can even seem by the play of chance that it's going the wrong way around. It's only when you get very big numbers that you can trust the results. And it's not that statisticians think that all women are the same, so we just get big numbers, they're all the same. It's actually because patients are all different that you need the big numbers. If you get big numbers, those differences will just average out. It's when you get the small numbers that, because patients are very different from each other, then the play of chance, who just happens to get allocated the new treatment, who doesn't, can dominate the results, and you can finish up with a false negative if you've got something that does have a small gain. Obviously, it would be nice if we got something that had such a huge effect. We don't need big numbers. But where we don't have these things, it's better to get the big numbers and at least recognize the small effects so that you know about them when you're making your treatment choices.
The other thing I think is interesting about this trial, and again, I remember how people were viewing it when you first started talking about it, was the simplicity of design in terms of how you went about doing it. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, we wanted results that would apply to all women with ER-positive disease just around the world. And so we wanted numbers that were really big. And yet doctors were quite uncertain as to what to do. Some doctors wanted to keep on. Some patients wanted to keep on. And we said, okay, if you definitely want to keep on, then keep on. Some patients definitely wanted to stop, especially when they saw that clinical alert. It was 1995 that alert came out, incidentally, saying don't go beyond 5 years. It could well be dangerous. Well, after that, a lot of people definitely wanted to stop at 5 years. And so if they thought that they knew what they wanted to do, we said, okay, do what you want. It doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. You do what you want. But it was where the doctor and patient were both substantially uncertain what to do, then we said, if you both feel substantially uncertain, then by all means, join the study. It'll be chosen at random and it'll be too late to make much difference to you. But in the 2010s, we'll know that answer and we'll be able to tell that answer to other women. And many people thought, well, why not? It's a small difference one way or another. Maybe it'll do more harm than good. Maybe it'll do more good than harm. But anyway, the difference is going to be quite small either way. And so they joined the study. We got 13,000 in the Atlas trial and then another 7,000 in another trial called ATOM, which is probably going to be presented at ASCO this year. And so by this time next year, we'll have data on 20,000 women, where half of them got 5 years of tamoxifen, half of them got 10 years of tamoxifen. And that, I think, will really tie down that question of 10 years of tamoxifen versus 5 years of tamoxifen. Yes, there are additional side effects. Tamoxifen can cause pulmonary embolus. Tamoxifen can cause endometrial cancer. But the gain, although the gain is small, it's 10 times bigger than the hazards in terms of life or death. It's a small gain, but then the hazards of continuing are 10 times smaller. So I think with these circumstances, many people will carry on either with tamoxifen or with some other drug that blocks the estrogen receptors. It doesn't have to be tamoxifen. I think we should see this as a trial of longer versus shorter endocrine treatment. So it's longer versus shorter endocrine treatment. We happen to have studied tamoxifen, but we could have studied some other endocrine treatment. I think the conclusion that 10 years of endocrine treatment is a bit better than 5 years of endocrine treatment for keeping your cancer from recurring, for giving you improved long-term survival. I think that conclusion will continue even if people move on from tamoxifen to other such drugs. I think what's been interesting is the timescale, is when do you see the benefit? Because if you go back to the old trials of 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing, so this is before Atlas and ATOM. Atlas and ATOM are saying, is 10 years of tamoxifen better than 5 years of tamoxifen? But the old trials were saying, is 5 years of tamoxifen better than nothing? And yes, 5 years of tamoxifen is better than nothing, but most of the benefit comes after the treatment has stopped. So 5 years of tamoxifen is better than nothing in terms of you've got some small gain in terms of 5 year survival, but you've got a gain that's three times as big in terms of 15 year survival. So in the period between year 5 and year 15, there's a delayed benefit, there's a carryover benefit from those first 5 years of tamoxifen. So those are the trials of 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing. They provide added protection not only in the first 5 years, but also in the second 5 years, and also in the third 5 years. So if you take 5 years of tamoxifen, you've got a lower death rate during years 10 to 15. So there's this delayed benefit. Well, if the same is true in these trials of 10 years of tamoxifen versus 5 years of tamoxifen, if you've got again to wait 10 years after treatment finishes to see the full benefit, then if we can follow up Atlas and ATOM for another 5 years, we might see a further small gain as a delayed benefit of having carried on to 10 years. I mean, all the treatment is finished in both arms, and all the women have finished their treatment, but if we just keep on following up, seeing what happens to them, we may find additional benefit. To judge by the old trials of 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing, we may well see a little additional benefit if we follow them up for another 5 years. Mind you, that will take us on until something like 2017, 2018, which will be actually the 40th anniversary of my first involvement with tamoxifen trials back in 1978.
An amazing accomplishment, and I would refer everybody to the publication that came out on this in The Lancet, and looking at that, a couple of the numbers, you know, it's interesting you talk about the modest effect, and I guess the numbers that I got attracted to is ER positive, and first of all, in terms of any death, I see hazard rate of 0.87, so 13% relative reduction. Is that kind of the key number in terms of efficacy that you look at?
No, it isn't. The key result, I think, is not the result during years 5 to 9 after diagnosis. The key result is what we see during years 10 to 15 after diagnosis. In other words, after the 10 years of treatment have ended. Because 5 years of tamoxifen has such a nice effect. It protects you during the 5 years you're taking it and during the next 5 years after that. So if you try 5 years versus 10 years of tamoxifen, during the first 5 years, you're still protected. Even if you stopped tamoxifen at 5 years, you're still protected by the first 5 years you took it. And then that protection fades. It's not so great after year 10. And that's where taking it longer really comes in. You take tamoxifen for the first decade in order to produce protection during the second decade after you got breast cancer. You've got to think on really quite a long time scale here. So I think we've got to think of when you get breast cancer, if you take tamoxifen for 10 years, for a decade of tamoxifen that is, then you'll get protection not only during the decade while you're taking it, but also in the decade after you finish taking it, there'll be a carryover benefit, and it might well last for a decade. The benefits of 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing, the benefits of tamoxifen there lasted for a decade after treatment finished, and the benefits of taking tamoxifen for 10 years may last for a decade after treatment finished. But the benefit is in that second decade. And I think the results, it's the results in years 10 to 14 that I find really exciting. Because there, you've got a reduction of something like a quarter in the breast cancer recurrence rate, breast cancer death rate.
If I'm looking at the right numbers, what I see is years 5 to 9, the hazard rate is 0.97. So, you know, getting back to your point, the protection's still there. But then the hazard rate after 10 years is 0.71, 29%. That's for mortality. And the recurrence is pretty similar, 0.75 hazard rate after 10 years.
Yes. So what it means is that you've got a lower breast cancer recurrence rate and a lower breast cancer death rate during years 10 to 15 after your cancer. Now, this may not matter very much if you got your cancer at the age of 80 or 85, because you know, probably heart disease or something else will carry you off before you get to 15 years after your breast cancer. But a lot of women get breast cancer when they're 45 or younger. And if you're 45, then you want not just to survive to age 50 or 55, you know, you want to live on to 65, 75, 85 like any other woman. And so we've got to think, what does a decade of tamoxifen do to breast cancer mortality during the decade while you're taking it? And during the decade after you're taking it, what does it do to 20 years survival? And within about 5 years, we'll have the answer to that question from the long-term follow-up of Atlas and Atom. I think, obviously what we hope, is that the benefit turns out to be a bit better than we've seen so far. And we hope that it's going to be reinforced by the results from Atom, which we'll find out this time next year. So I think it'll be by the late 2010s, we've got the final answer on 10 years of tamoxifen versus 5 years of tamoxifen. What does it do to 20 years survival? And that's an important question for a young woman who gets breast cancer.
So I want to ask you about some other endpoints that were reported. First, pulmonary embolus. I see here the actual numbers, 41 versus 21 absolute numbers. Obviously, a very small percent, but increased risk in the patients getting 10 years. Actually, vascular death looks pretty similar. Heart disease, a little bit lower. What about these findings?
The heart disease might be real. As we stated in the Atlas Protocol back in the mid-1990s, tamoxifen does have slightly favorable effects on blood lipids, and these might produce some reduction in heart disease in the probability of having a heart attack and in the probability of dying from heart disease. And we did see a significant reduction in the number of women who finished up going into hospital for a heart attack. But I think that we were perhaps a bit on the lucky side there. There might be some real effect, some real protective effect against heart disease, but my suspicion is that the results are a little bit too good to be true.
Well, as the numbers I see here, 178 versus 205, so, you know, a little bit of a drop.
Yes, yeah, that's right. I think although there is an increase in pulmonary embolus, there might well be a decrease in heart disease. And although the FDA has warned that tamoxifen might cause stroke, we haven't seen any excess of stroke during the treatment period, either in the ATLAS trial or in the old trials of 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing. So I think that might have been a mistaken result just from one particular study, which does happen. I mean, this old warning about, you know, don't go on beyond 5 years of tamoxifen, that's an example of just a mistake from one study based on numbers that were too small. I think that the fear that tamoxifen might cause stroke could be another thing like that. Anyway, we didn't see any excess of stroke. And as you say, overall vascular mortality was slightly lower with longer-term tamoxifen than with shorter-term tamoxifen. So I think vascular mortality, vascular events aren't the main thing to worry about. In terms of pulmonary embolus deaths, it was something like 10 versus 6, even though we've got something like 13,000 women. So it's a real hazard. That is a real hazard, but it's small. The hazard that I think is of more concern is that it does increase the incidence of cancer of the endometrium, because tamoxifen binds the estrogen receptors in the womb, in the endometrium, but it stimulates them. It doesn't block them, it stimulates them. So it binds the breast receptors and blocks them, but it binds to the estrogen receptors on the uterus and stimulates them. And therefore, it can actually cause endometrial cancer, and it can cause death from endometrial cancer. But that's the hazard that I said is 10 times smaller than the benefit. So the absolute risk of tamoxifen causing endometrial cancer, 10 years of tamoxifen causing endometrial cancer, is a few per thousand, whereas the absolute gain is a few percent, depending on what your background risk is anyway, but it's 10 times bigger. But that's a real side effect.
I guess a key issue in terms of endometrial cancer and tamoxifen is menopausal status, with the risk presumably mainly being in postmenopausal patients.
Well, certainly our data would suggest that, yes, because before the menopause, the endometrium, the womb, is being stimulated strongly by the body's own hormones, and so a bit of extra stimulation from tamoxifen doesn't make much difference here or there. Whereas in a postmenopausal woman, you aren't getting that natural stimulation, and so the stimulation from tamoxifen is importantly relevant. It's a bigger fraction of what's going on. So there's little or no hazard of endometrial cancer in premenopausal women. And in postmenopausal women, of course, who've had a hysterectomy, there is no hazard because there's no uterus there. But if you've got an intact uterus, then it does get stimulated. It can cause thickening. It can cause a bit of excess bleeding. It can cause endometrial cancer. So doctors check for evidence of bleeding. And in general, they'd pick up an endometrial cancer in time for it to be cured. It's generally a lot easier to cure an endometrial cancer than it is to cure a breast cancer. So there's far more cases than there are deaths, but it's a real hazard. And it would be nice to have endocrine treatments that don't have this side effect. There's no reason for something that blocks the breast receptors to stimulate the uterine receptors. You don't have to have that. So you could get endocrine treatments that don't do that.
Well, you know, aromatase inhibitors is right out there in terms of that. And it is worth keeping in mind, though, because just in terms of discussing this with a patient up front, I mean, you know, they might get it even coincidentally, but just to let them know about it. I mean, the actual numbers here, you have a 13,000 patient trial, and the numbers that I see in terms of endometrial cancers is 116 versus 63, 17 versus 11 deaths. So, you know, even though the relative increase is there, it's not an absolutely huge number, but just something to keep in mind in terms of, you know, screening and education.
There is other evidence on the deaths. I think if you said 5 years of tamoxifen versus nil, there's a lot of other evidence on this. This isn't the only evidence on it. So 5 years of tamoxifen versus nil produces a risk of death from endometrial cancer, which is of the order of 2 per 1,000. Going on for 10 years instead of just 5 years is producing an extra risk, which eventually, by the time you get out to year 15, would be of the order of another 2 per 1,000. So overall, a decade of tamoxifen is producing a risk which is of the order of 4 per 1,000 of causing death from endometrial cancer over the next 15 years. So it's a real side effect. Sure, the benefits are 10 times bigger, but we would like to get those benefits without that side effect. But, you know, while we don't have the perfect drug, then you may well want to get the benefits, so you may well want to use tamoxifen. But there's no reason to have those side effects. We need things that achieve this without those side effects. And aromatase inhibitors as well, you know, they also have quite serious side effects in terms of loss of bone density, causing pathological fractures and so on. You know, we still need to get the perfect endocrine treatment, but what we do know is that endocrine treatment really does substantially reduce 15-year mortality from breast cancer. And I hope we'll find that it'll reduce 20-year mortality even more than it reduces 15-year mortality. I'll tell you in 5 years' time.
The other factor that kind of comes into this whole equation is second breast cancers. And it's interesting in terms of just 5 versus 10 years, 419 versus 467.
Oh, yeah.
It's statistically significant, too, 12% relative reduction.
Oh, yeah. If you'd say, what's the overall effect of tamoxifen on the probability of developing a new cancer? Well, the reduction in the risk of getting into cancer in the opposite breast is about the same as the increase in the risk of getting cancer of the endometrium, and cancer of the breast is a more dangerous disease than cancer of the endometrium. So overall, it's definitely doing more good than harm, but still, we need research, we need development of things that will do the good without the harm. And I think that that's a reasonable hope for drug development.
Any comments on Trevor Powell's editorial that went along with this paper?
Well, it was nice to have such an enthusiastic editorial. He said there should be a new era in the treatment of breast cancer. I feel it's just another small gain. It's a gain that we hoped we'd see back in the early 1990s. We've worked on this now, raising the money for this trial, then doing the trial for 20 years, and we've got another 5 years to go to follow it up and find the final results. But it's a real small gain. It's real. And I think it will apply to future endocrine treatments that people develop, which have the effects without the adverse side effects. So I think this finding about longer versus shorter treatment, that, you know, you really want to carry on with endocrine treatment for a decade rather than just for 5 years, I think that will carry over to the drugs of the future. So I think it's a very nice result. It's, you know, bloody hell, we worked for it for decades. First the trials of tamoxifen versus nothing, then the trials of 5 years versus 2 years, and now the trials of 10 years versus 5 years. So certainly there's something to celebrate.
It really is. And, you know, actually mentioning Trevor Powell's actually made me think about something else. And I don't know if you want to comment on this or not, but it's kind of interesting. Some of the things that are going on over the last few years in terms of bisphosphonates, you know, these huge trials trying to see if there's a benefit in the adjuvant setting. Have you thought about getting involved with that in terms of some kind of meta-analysis? And what do you think about what's going on right now?
Well, there are 30 trials of bisphosphonate versus no bisphosphonate. Bisphosphonates are drugs which are intended just to stabilize bone. That was what people were thinking of them doing. So they've done trials of them in breast cancer. And some of those trials have suggested that actually you've got a lower death rate from breast cancer. And people thought maybe it's because it's preventing bony metastases from taking root. Who knows? But the first question is it real? And there are 30 such trials, and they've all agreed to collaborate. And so I hope that the EBC-TCG meeting in September this year will produce the first definitive meta-analysis of the bisphosphonate trials. Until then, I don't have an opinion. I'd say it's possible that we've got just selective emphasis on the most promising bits of the evidence. It's possible that there is a real benefit there. By everybody sharing their data on the bisphosphonate trials as they did on the tamoxifen trials, we will get a real answer. But that's the process that's going to be going on all this year, getting the data in, getting the data straight, making sure there are no mistakes on it, to and fro with the trialists and all the details. And it'll come out by September. It'll be presented to the trialists for them to review in early October. And, you know, perhaps it'll be presented at San Antonio next December. I don't know. But that's the plan. Anyway, it will happen. People have agreed to share their data. But if they share their data, then we've got to get everything together and then discuss it with the trialists who've produced the data to see how they see it. And then when there's a consensus as to how to view the evidence, then present it to a wider audience for discussion and publish it so that it can be discussed. You've got to actually work with the trialists in this process. You know, one time, I think in the 1990s, when one of our meta-analyses got published, it got written up in Time magazine saying, look at these results. Meta-analysis is a new technique that avoids the ethical problems of actually doing trials, which I think counts as the most ridiculous comment ever. I mean, if people don't do the trials, there isn't any meta-analysis. And you've got to work with the trialists if you're going to get a good meta-analysis. Sometimes people try and do meta-analyses just from the published papers, but it's not very satisfactory. You know, very often, I think these meta-analyses from the published papers have come up with wrong answers, with answers that aren't really as sensitive as they ought to be, sometimes with qualitatively wrong answers. So I think the process of working with the trialists to get their agreement to share their data, which they spent years and years getting, sometimes 10, 15 years getting, and then going over it with them, and then publishing something in the names of everybody, I think it's a slow process, but it's worth it. I hope the bisphosphonate story turns out to be true. I hope there is another further protection there. I'm not convinced as yet, but it would be very nice to be wrong.
I know right from the beginning, one of the things that you felt was very important was to get each patient individually. Looking back now, it sounds like you still believe in that. And is that what you're going to try to do with this bisphosphonate analysis?
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, we're going to get data on each individual woman ever randomized into any trial of bisphosphonate versus no bisphosphonate. All of the trialists have agreed. Nobody's holding out on it. But they've agreed partly because they're going to be involved in looking at the results, trying to interpret them, trying to comment on what's wrong with their own trial, what's wrong with other people's trials, then we'll get everything straight and then we'll present it to a wider audience for further discussion. But I think that in the chemotherapy trials, that's been very important. In a way, tamoxifen is somewhat simpler, but I think in the tamoxifen trials, it's been important as well. And I think we'd never have got this result about, you know, what's the effect of 5 years of tamoxifen, not just during the first 5 years, but during the second 5 years and during the third 5 years. So what's the effect of 5 years of tamoxifen on 15-year survival? We'd never have got that just from the published papers. You know, the trials would have just given up, gone their way. They wouldn't have, you know, their own trials, most of the trials that contributed to that finding, taken on their own, were non-significant. Nobody would follow them up if they weren't all collaborating in this process. So I think it's been useful there. The trouble is breast cancer has such a long natural history. I think if you take a disease with a rapid natural history, you know, say penicillin for penicillin-sensitive pneumonia, well, I mean, that's a bit too extreme. But if you've got a rapid outcome, then I think doctors are thoughtful. They'll observe it. They'd probably get the right answer anyway without a formal meta-analysis. But where you've got differences that are developing over time, then I think you really do need a formal process of bringing all the trials together and looking at the results in the first 5 years, second 5 years, third 5 years, getting everybody to comment on them and looking at the side effects in the first 5 years, second 5 years, third 5 years. You know, probably if we hadn't got a formal meta-analysis, we'd get more, you know, false positive claims about side effects. You know, the old claim that 10 years of tamoxifen was more dangerous than 5 years of tamoxifen, which has just been wiped out by the accumulation of 10 times as much data. The claim that tamoxifen can cause stroke, which really isn't supported by the evidence. And you know, when people in a completely different disease, if you look at statins and heart attacks, well, actually, if you look at all the trials of statins and heart attacks, what's the net effect on cancer? Zero. The relative risk is 1.00. We've got 200,000 randomized patients now. Put them all together, the relative risk is 1.00. And no particular type of cancer is significantly increased or decreased. So all these scares about cholesterol lowering and cancer back in the 1990s, they're all rubbish. They're just wrong. It was selective emphasis on particular bits of the data. But if you took the statin trials separately and you'd said in each of these different trials, is there an excess of some particular type of cancer? Well, yes, there is. And, you know, then everybody would jump up and down about, look at this hazard. But it's when you put them all together, all of these apparent hazards are false alarms. No type of cancer has significantly increased. Overall cancer is totally unaffected in the statin trials. Well, statins are really important drugs. They're really getting the national heart disease death rates down. And you don't want false positives on side effects. So I think bringing all the trials together, getting the evidence on each particular patient, I think is useful for the assessment of main effects, particularly main effects after the first few years. And it's important for the assessment of side effects. Sometimes you'll confirm a side effect, like endometrial cancer, is not totally clear in ATLAS, but it is totally clear when you look at all the trials. And sometimes you'll refute fears about particular side effects. Yeah, I think it's just a lot of work, but it's been very good on breast cancer.
I'm really thrilled to hear about this bisphosphonate meta-analysis. I kind of feel like people sort of kind of given up on it. You know, there was all that excitement a few years ago. Mike Nant presented the Austrian data, and then we started seeing negative trials, and now I don't even see that much interest. So I'm thrilled that you're doing this. But one thing I wonder about, you know, and this goes back to your breast cancer meta-analyses up to now, people are bringing up the issue of menopausal status and bisphosphonates and sort of estrogen status in terms of like the Austrian patients who had LHRH agonists. And I know that's been a problem in the past. A lot of times I think you've used age rather than the menopausal status in these. How are you going to approach this critical issue in terms of bisphosphonates?
Well, I think what the trialists have decided to do, we do quite often have information on menopausal status, but also, what we've got definite information on for all the women is age. And they've asked us not any longer to split age at 50, under 50 or over 50, but instead to split age at 45 and 55. So we'll have those who are under 45, they'd nearly all be premenopausal. Those 45 to 54, who some would be premenopausal, some postmenopausal, some perimenopausal. And then those who are over 55, pretty well all of whom would be either just finishing or well postmenopausal. So we'll be splitting the women into three groups rather than two. That's what the trials decided. They decided they trusted the information on age much more than they trusted the information on menopausal status. And the bottom group and the top group will be pretty nearly all premenopausal, and pretty nearly all postmenopausal, so that's how we're going to approach it. But we'll use the information on menopausal status as well, where we've got it.
I mean, what I've seen, even though I know they weren't planned analyses and all, I'd be putting my money on postmenopausal women having a benefit. But we'll see, huh?
I really have no opinion. I have a strong opinion as to whether the evidence should all be put together. I don't have a strong opinion at this point as to what it's going to show.
Yeah, well, maybe you can do another one of your things about polling people about what they think they're going to see, and then we'll see what they actually do see. But that should be really interesting. Well, I'm cautiously optimistic that I'll be interviewing you at San Antonio next year right after you present the bisphosphonate meta-analysis, but maybe that's a little bit optimistic. But anything else you want to say about any of the work that you've been involved with the last couple, year or two, anything that's come out that we haven't talked about?
I think that it's worth remembering that with breast cancer, more than any other of the common cancers, we've got a real reduction in mortality. If you look at what's been achieved by the treatment of cancer, we've had big reductions in mortality from some of the rare cancers, and we've had moderate reductions in mortality from some of the common cancers, not very great. And of course, we've had huge decreases in mortality because so many people have stopped smoking. That's, far bigger effect than any effect of treatment. But actually, of the changes in breast cancer mortality over the last 20 years, really the biggest has been, in absolute terms, has been the reduction in breast cancer mortality. And I'd like to thank the doctors who've done these trials, the women who've taken part in the trials. Hundreds of thousands of women have agreed to join randomized trials. Thousands of doctors have worked on these trials. They've all agreed to share their data. And we've got the privilege of looking at the overall results and then discussing them with the trialists. And when you get a small but real gain, like the one last month of 10 years of tamoxifen really is better than 5 years of tamoxifen, then it's based on decades of research before that. First, 5 years of tamoxifen versus nothing, and then for 20 years, 10 years versus five. And I feel very pleased to see these reductions. And overall mortality in the United States, just the overall probability of dying before you're old, it's decreased enormously over the last few decades in the United States and the United Kingdom. I'm 69 now. I've always just said that old age starts at 70. And so if you say, what's the chances of dying before you're 70 in Britain now? Well, it's half what it was 40 years ago. It's gone down by more than half in men and a little bit less than half in women because of the enormous decrease in death from smoking among men. And I think seen in this context, the improvement in the treatment of heart disease, of breast cancer, and the changes in death from tobacco, I think overall it's produced a very nice change in the human condition. We've now got, we've got such a huge reduction in mortality in middle age. The first half of the 20th century saw a huge reduction in childhood mortality, a reduction in mortality before middle age. And the second half of the 20th century, particularly the last quarter of the century, has seen a very nice reduction in death in middle age. And this, in terms of treatment of cancer, is a real and appreciable contribution to that. So it's very nice to look back over the last few decades.
All right, Richard, it's been a pleasure as always. Learned a lot as always.
Thank you very much indeed.
Can't wait to hear about that bisphosphonate thing.
Okay, well, come as our guest to the meeting on the 2nd or the 4th of October then. You're not allowed to report on it until it's published.